If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Welcome to the Dear Love Joy podcast. It's a special. Woo-hoo! Today's guest is Richard Osman. We'll be having a conversation with him about pointless, being in front of the camera and being behind the camera. He's got some very interesting views on, because he works behind the camera, doesn't he, on development and come up with ideas and pitching ideas. So he'll be finding all about the TV industry. Also, his connection to Suede. We'll find out about how he fared in the Britpop scene. And we'll be talking to him about the World Cup of Everything, his book. Have you read this book yet, Mark?
I haven't, no. I've been eyeing it up. I'm hoping you're going to let me have it.
Let me run through one of the categories for you before we get there. Okay, let's do band, shall we, because you like your music. Wham v Blur.
I'd go with Blur, but...
Okay, well, that's it. That's all it is. Pink Floyd v One Direction.
Pink Floyd, I suppose, yep.
Pet Shop Boys, Iron Maiden.
Oh, Christ. I mean...
Come on. Game's a quick game.
Can it be postponed?
No, Pet Shop Boys v Iron Maiden.
Pet goes to penalties, probably Iron Maiden. But
The Clash v Coldplay.
Oh dear, Clash, but yeah.
Five Star v... What? Oh dear, Clash easy.
No, but...
Five Star v Beatles.
No, but it's cool not to... Oh, Beatles, obviously. It's cool not to like Coldplay, and I don't think there's anything wrong with them.
No, there's not. They're right. Pulp v Pretenders. The Pretenders.
I'd go Pulp, but that's only because I was...
The Who versus Bananarama. Stop making up excuses.
Who?
Just do
all
it.
Right. All right.
Depeche Mode v Take That.
Richard Osman's much nicer than this.
Depeche Mode v Take That.
I would take that.
Stone Roses, Duran Duran.
Oh, Stone Roses, come on.
Kinks v Sugar Babes.
Kinks.
Dire Straits, The Rolling Stones.
Rolling Stones, I think.
Soul to Soul, Roxy Music. Oh, it's kind of toughy, kind of, that one,
tough,
yeah. Soul to
one.
Soul, I'm going with.
Okay, all right. Didn't realise you were now manager.
I'm not, go on. Who do you think? Soul to Soul, Roxy Music?
Roxy Music.
JLS, Oasis.
Oasis, come on.
Radiohead, Eurythmics.
Radiohead, I suppose, yep.
Spice Girls, The Smiths.
Oh, The Smiths, sorry.
you see, paused, I thought, hold on. Yeah, so anyway, we'll talk to him all about everything, the World Cup of everything. Hey, let's meet him. Here is Richard Osman.
This is just a guide to modern life. Modern life is hard to get just right. It can frustrate you and annoy. And if it does, right into Dear Love Joy.
Richard, welcome to my kitchen. Thank you for coming, Tim.
It's very well appointed.
Very well appointed.
Mm.
What does that mean?
That means it's got you have nice things in here. I like your hob.
That oven costs a fortune.
I've been admiring your hot water tap.
Yeah, the hot water tap.
Oh,
the infamous
my goodness.
Hot water tap. We talked about it on Sunday Brunch.
Oh, it's
good,
quite
isn't
something.
It?
It's amazing.
It's amazing. Hey, listen, every guest who comes on our show, we get a present for.
No way.
As it's Christmas time. I noticed when you're on Sunday Brunch, you've got a sweet tooth.
Oh, yeah.
So I've never had one of these, but this is a panettone. It's
no
a
way.
Traditional Christmas cake.
Yeah,
I've
I
never had
panettone.
One. Have you had one?
Thank you, sir. I have had panettone. I love a panettone.
Yeah, I don't
Thank
know.
Thank you so much. I used to rent a flat from London's Panettone King, and
really?
Yeah, and he would he was a lovely fellow. He made ice cream as well, so we had ice cream and panettone. He would always bring Ooh. Stuff around. I love a panettone.
Was he Italian?
He was Italian. Yeah. It's weird. It's so weird how you can pick up on the clues, isn't it?
It's good.
Yeah, like
good
a modern
like that,
day Columbo.
Yeah,
thank you. I love that. That will that
always. I've never had one. It just always looks like dry cake to me. Is it?
No, it's really nice. Yeah,
is
it's
it?
Yeah, it's absolutely delicious.
Well, enjoy that over Christmas, and thank you very much for coming in. Because you're in the middle of the World Cup of Christmas songs.
Mm.
I mean, this will go out next week, but it launched today. How's that going at the moment?
Yeah, good. It's interesting because they're such fun, these World Cups on Twitter, and we raise money for charity with them. But actually, they're so stressful to run because, sport, you have to exactly, I've drawn them together, I've seeded everything properly. You know, I draw them at the right time, and then you have to have them, the votes have to go on for the right amount of time, and then you have to do round two at the right time. And so keeping on top of it and, managing all the admin of it is stressful. It's a fun thing to do, though.
Could you explain to me, are there seeds then?
Well, I personally, just because I'm a TV producer, if I've got 32 songs, I'll make sure that there's a couple of pop songs, there's a kind of silly song. You know, I won't draw kind of Slade against the Pogues against Wham in the first round. Right. You know, I'll make sure there's a couple of suckers in each group. And then, because then it gets more and more kind of tense. But funnily enough, Christmas Songs is one of those weird ones where even though I've done that, there's some tough rounds. 250,000 votes already. It's only been on air for 3 hours.
Yeah, it's amazing. Yeah. You put up Betfair, I've done a book on it. Last Christmas at 3-1 at the moment.
That's, yeah, Fairy Tale in New York. I mean, people will know the result by this time. But yeah, Fairy Tale in New York is a heavy odds on favourite. See, it's interesting because, you know, if you actually go by sales, every single year, here's the top three. Fairy Tale of New York sells the third most of all the Christmas songs. Last Christmas sells the second most. And Mariah Carey always sells the most. Right, every single year. And she's 8-1.
Oh, sorry, I hadn't opened it up. I've just seen, yeah, Fairy Tale of New York is at the top there. Yeah. But you've also got Stay Another Day, E17. Now, that is my favourite Christmas song, but it's not really a Christmas song.
It's interesting, isn't it? That, isn't it? Down the bottom of all of these lists, like last year I did Christmas films and people got furious about Die Hard. Is that a Christmas movie?
Yeah.
I think, you know what, if enough people vote for it, then it's a Christmas song, isn't it? Because a Christmas song is in the ears of the listener. Yeah. And if something makes you feel Christmassy, it's got Christmas bells on it. I think surely it's... I didn't include Power of Love, which some people asked me to, because I think that's just not a Christmas song. Well, it was Christmas number one.
Yeah.
That was the closest to getting. Everyone's furious that "Step Into Christmas" by Elton John's not there. Like it would have won. You know, people always say that they some obscure thing and say, "Why is this not here?" You think, well, it could be, but it'd be knocked. It's going to be knocked out in round one by Wizard. I mean.
So how's the book doing?
Yeah,
so
it's doing amazingly. I mean, we do pointless books every year. We've done them, and they've always sold all right. But this one's gone crazy. It's sort of in the Sunday Times bestseller list and all this kind of stuff. So, I'm so chuffed because I love it. I really, 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 really enjoyed writing it because there's lots of kind of little facts about, you know, the history of chocolate and the history of biscuits, which sounds ridiculous. But it's amazing. You know, all of these things, all of these sweet companies, they all started in small back rooms, you know, in Barnsley or in Cricklewood or something.
Yeah.
And now they're all owned by like Nabisco or the Pension Fund of Canada. It's so fascinating about the way the world has gone. But no, people seem to love it. People are, you know, already furious with me for the arguments it's caused.
Remind us how it started in the first place.
Well, again, it started on Twitter. I did a World Cup of Chocolate to see what people thought would be the best chocolate. And, you know, we had 2 million votes or something ridiculous. And people were still furious with me. They're still saying, no, I'm afraid you got that wrong. and you think, oh, okay. So I've put together 14 of different World Cups that people could play at home or in the pub with their mates, just because then they can't complain to me because it's their fault if their favourite thing doesn't win. And, you know, so there's World Cup of British bands in there. There's British sitcoms, which I did a live tour, and people go crazy about the British sitcom one. There's literally sort of fist fights breaking out in Ilkley over, you know, whether Only Fools and Horses is better than Fawlty Towers. But it's lovely. It's so inconsequential. But we love an argument, right?
Yeah, it's such a brilliant idea, especially when you're calling it the World Cup and they knock each other out. I
mean,
Is it your best idea you've ever had?
I don't know. Well, you know, all of my ideas are pretty much the same. Most of my career has been based on asking people stuff and, you know, getting feedback. You know, things like 8 out of 10 Cats and all sorts of shows where lots of things are based on polling. That's why I quite like it. I quite like what that brings. Family Fortunes, I think, is the best format of all time. It's an idea, you know, it's... lots of people do these sort of knockout competitions and, you know, all sorts of people. It's just Twitter. It was perfect for Twitter. As soon as they brought out the polls as well, I just thought, oh, people will love this. And lots of people do them, but it's nice where you can gain a little bit of ownership of an area. And that's the thing about being a TV producer. You're always thinking, how do I format this so that people really, really engage with it?
And this has got TV show written all over it in my mind. It's the TV show that everyone's been looking for, the one that they want you to interact with. You know, everybody, all the TV shows go, download the app so you can play along at home. This has got that written all over it, and yet you don't want to turn it into a TV show.
Not really. I mean, it's interesting that thing with play along at home apps, because, you know, we've had those things for a long time and sort of online things. And so my day job and the creative director at Endemol Shine, and for years people have tried to do shows with apps, and I'm not entirely sure if any of them have ever worked. You know, it turns out that people find their own way of interacting with things, which is everyone is two-screening, which is, you know, they're looking at Twitter while they're watching a show. And, you know, making jokes about Strictly or talking about Anton DeBeck or making jokes about I'm a Celebrity is much more fun than playing along with a show. You know, if you want to play along with something, you do that in your own time. You know, no one has yet married the two concepts together
and made it work. This is it.
I don't know. I sort of think there's, you know, everyone sort of thinks, oh, we have to mold these platforms together. And sometimes I think this works beautifully for Twitter. And I see that. I can feel it. As a producer, I can feel that. I know it all fits into shape and it gets its form perfectly. There's no kind of, you know, edges sticking out. You know, I know it just works. The second you start thinking about it for telly, you just think, yeah, but what is that? And, you know, what are you going to talk about in the, you know, because this
got
is
Scarlett Moffat, she's going,
I love Scarlett Moffat.
Chocolate egg.
Yeah.
And then you've got, give me another celebrity, Fern, Simon Rimmer.
Yeah.
Who's sticking up for Twix.
Yeah, he probably would as well, Rimmer, wouldn't he? He's such an idiot.
I can see it now.
Yeah, but you know what? I think people prefer arguing with their friends than hearing Simon Rimmer and Scarlett Moffat argue.
Okay.
That's my opinion with this, which is why, you know, lots of, you know, people do try and use Twitter to pitch TV shows, and I think you can just use it for its own good. You know, yeah. It just exists in its own, you know, we're all in a world now, presenters and what have you, and producers, where everyone's obsessed with, you know, how do you monetize different media? Yeah. You know, how do you monetize Twitter? How do you monetize Facebook? And funnily enough, from behind the camera, it's quite hard. Quite hard if you're Endemol to monetize Twitter. If you're in front of camera or something like that, it's quite easy to monetize it because it's sort of like direct mailing, you know, because everyone who sort of is interested in you can hear stuff from you. And if you do have a good idea or if you do have a good joke, you can instantly share it. And, you know, that there's, I always think with, you know, you get some of these, Labour, there's people on Twitter with some of the left wing commentators on Twitter who we don't think of as venal and what have you. And I want to say to people, you know, if you've got 500,000 Twitter followers, that's $100,000 advance for your next book without even thinking about it. So if you're like one of these Labour firebrands who sort of builds up their Twitter following, yeah, and you just think, oh, that's great because they do it, it's all for free, they're monetizing it. You know, every time they bring a book out, they're getting a huge amount of money because of their Twitter following. And I don't think people really know that about, you know, and so some people, I think it's fine. But I think occasionally you look at people, you just think you're saying something deeply controversial. People think you're telling the truth, you know, as you see it. And you're building up this sort of Twitter following and it's instantly monetizable.
I can't do the thing on Twitter where, like, I talked to Piers Morgan about this once. He goes, just go on there and say what you want and just accept it. And
oh,
I'm like,
no,
I can't do it. And I genuinely think he believes the stuff he says, you know, and he goes on there and he really plays the game, doesn't he?
I can't do it. I can't bear conflict.
No, nor can I.
I really can't. I hate it. That's why this, to me, a World Cup is perfect because everyone's arguing. Yeah. On my timeline, endlessly. But even where people are saying, why isn't Step Into Christmas there? I'm a bit kind of, I wish I had. And I know it doesn't matter. I know they're having fun and all this kind of stuff. But you know, I take it really personally. And so I cannot have any sort of conflicts. The second anyone has a go at me, I just mute them. Never block anyone.
The amount of tweets I've written and then deleted before I've said, honestly.
I think that's very wise.
Because I just can't be bothered with it. And Mark and I were doing we wanted to get people's views on whether men should always pay on a first date.
Yeah.
We spent about 2 or 3 out, really?
Yeah, of course.
Why?
Because otherwise the whole order of the world breaks down.
Oh, Richard.
Of course they should.
Well, I asked my 15-year-old daughter and they laughed and said, no, of course they shouldn't.
Yeah, but you know what? But I think if someone didn't offer, you would be like, hold on, that tells you a little something about them.
That's your age.
I don't think it is.
That is, because my daughters want pure equality in every sense of it.
Yeah,
so
they would find it
absurd that a man would think it was his.
But
right,
here's the
pay.
Thing, you know, some things happen for a reason. Somebody needs to pay is the truth, in the same way that someone needs to go through the door first. And it's sort of better to have a system. And what do you want to do? A height order? You know, so it's So long as you're not using as a way to gain control of a situation, which, you know, I believe you can open a door or pay for a meal without it being a power move, somebody's got to do it. You know, and otherwise you do that 10 minutes of, no, I'll get, you know, half and half. And even if it's half and half, you think, honestly, I'd rather not waste that extra 2 minutes of the fiddling about with the cards and all that kind of malarkey.
But doesn't it say that the man's financially more secure? Isn't that what it's sort of saying?
No, I don't think so. Listen, I think you have to judge yourself long-term in a relationship. And I think that that behavior would become very apparent very quickly if the man felt that that was the case. I don't think that the act of paying for a meal on a first date is essentially a sign that this guy is going to use his money to dominate, or that he earns more money than you, or anything like that. I think it's good to have a system. And as you say, I am old.
Yeah, I'm glad you said it, not me. Yeah. So we with the wording of it, though, we went through forever wording it because people were going to go, what about same sex? What about this? What about that? So we spent, we still got people picking us up on it, didn't they?
But you see on telly all the time now, people on any show, and you'll have done it yourself, where you say something and you think, oh, right, I know what the annoying people are going to say. So people go, don't figure out, I don't mean X, I don't mean Y. And we are legislating, we're running so much of our culture and so much of our television, we're legislating for 0.00001% of viewers who are the worst people in the world.
Okay, well, I'll bring, yes, exactly. And my problem with this is the television channels don't stick up for the talent. So as soon as someone says something, which is, say, let's do extreme. Someone says something racist or sexist, say something like that. Rather than going, right, that's so bad, we're going to sit down and educate you. Everyone just gets sacked. Obviously, we're in the sacking culture, where the John Ronson book. What do the companies do? Their employers do immediately. Anything happens, they sack them, and it's like this sacking culture. Rather than go, hey, do you know you said something really racist or sexist? You know, you shouldn't say that, and educate them. So I think this is the problem. So we're all terrified for our jobs all the
time. Well, my problem is, genuinely, I do think by and large we come from a background where those sort of things, we wouldn't say that sort of stuff, even accidentally. And so sometimes I have, if someone's in their 60s, I have a great deal more sympathy, because you just think, because so much of it is language, and you just you don't get the language. Some of them are bang to rights. Some people you just think, good, you know what, you shouldn't be where you are. I think, my big problem is pedants. those are the people that annoy me. I'm the same as you. I've got a 19-year-old daughter, and I understand the importance of language, and I understand the importance of letting the next generation fight their fights, and I get that, and I'll back them all the way. But it's pedants, and it's people who say, oh, actually, that's not actually a Christmas song. Because you think, I guess. And any television show you do, you just know, it's like whenever we have to do, Kings and Queens of England or Kings and Queens of Britain, and there's that bit in the middle, and you have to explain it in such detail, because two people will go, how dare you say that so-and-so was a king of the United Kingdom, and actually it was James the First of this, and you just think, just because of you, I've had to make this show 30 seconds more boring to explain something, and nobody else, nobody else minds. No one is anti-Scottish here, no one's anti-English, we're just trying to make a quiz show.
Yeah.
We're now having to jump through kind of 50 hoops.
I agree, and I always say, when people start hammering people for saying something, it's like, do you honestly think that person's a bad person, or they've just made a mistake with their language? And that's generally what they've
live
done.
Live TV, see, that's the thing. You're talking to a man who does 3 hours of live TV every Sunday.
I come off everywhere. I'd never read my Twitter after the show, because I've always said something that has offended somebody, and can't be bothered to read it anymore. So I wait a while, and then sometimes I'll read it, sometimes I won't. But do you know, I was talking to June Sapong about this actually on this podcast not so long ago, because we work in the media. Do you think we don't understand what's going on in the real world? We're really PC in our industry, aren't we?
I think, yes, I think we are, but I think that's good. I think it's a good thing. I think language is incredibly important. And I think that, listen, you mustn't ever lose sight of the fact that you are not dragging the country along with you when you do it. And that's the thing that a lot of people on the left don't understand. They think because they've won a culture war that they've won the war of hearts and minds, and they haven't. And that's why Brexit and Trump and all these things happen. Because, we think, oh, no, it's fine now because we know how to be respectful and we know this. And you think, no, you've changed the language, you've changed the discourse, and that's very important, but you haven't changed people's minds, is the truth. And that's a different thing to do, and it's a much longer process. But I do think it's incredibly important to be very careful with your language and to be respectful with your language, because I think the future is not ours. The next 10, 20, 30 years is not ours. It belongs to our kids. And, I want them to live in a world that's more respectful than ours. And I want them to live in a world where, things are more equal. And I honestly think we have a job there. But our job is not to believe that we're changing people's minds, because we're not. But I think you have to show, don't tell, all the time. And so long as you're respectful with your language and respectful towards people, then, it just seeps through. I was talking to my daughter about it the other day. I was talking about transgender issues, which I find fascinating, because it was not an issue when we were in our teens and 20s.
Yeah.
Homosexuality was an issue. This was not an issue, the transgender issue, and it's fascinating. So I said, look, talk me through it. Talk me through this whole thing. And she did, and it was fascinating. And, I bought wholesale what she was talking about. And I said, to me, it feels like the only thing I can do. So we've had transgender contestants on Pointless, and, it's occasionally you get kind of people tweet about it, and I always say, if ever they tweet, I say, like, anyone who's having a go at this contestant, don't watch. I don't want you watching, because it's not, you know. And, you know, my mum will say to me, because my mum is even further away from her experience, the whole transgender issue, and she'll say, oh, well, I was watching Pointless. And so now that woman on podium three, so she was transgender. And you go, yeah, yeah. And was a man, is now a woman, and you call her she. You go, yeah, that's exactly what it is. She goes, right, okay, got it. And that's all people need, is they need to be shown it.
Yeah,
and
not everybody's to, like that, are they?
Not everybody.
People
but
don't like change.
You have to
like...
get a, yeah, but you have to get a tipping point. That's the point. You literally just have to get enough people on your side,
yeah,
that society changes.
See, I do exactly the same as you. I sit and talk to my children about all those things so they can educate me,
yeah,
which they do. But when I sit with my mum and my kids and they discuss feminism, I love it, because both their ideas of feminism are so different.
It's amazing,
isn't it? And it is amazing, but they're both right.
Yeah.
And they both have different experiences. So it's I think there's conflicts is often between the generations more than anything else.
And you've got to be careful. You know, I've always say, don't judge people on their opinions, judge them on their motives. You know, because people might disagree with you and want the same thing. And if they do, then you can work with them.
Yeah.
You know, and don't immediately, because they have a slightly different opinion to you, suspect that their motive is different, because it may well not be. Lots of people are, by the way.
Yeah.
And you're never going to bring them over to your side.
People are scared of things which they don't understand.
Yeah,
often.
Of course.
And that's why, I mean, if you just sack everybody all the time who says something wrong or done. I mean, I'm talking not talking about TV here, I'm talking about in all walks of life. Rather than sit them down and say, why do you feel this way? I always think, you know, it's like, it seems the pointless idea to me just to keep sacking people.
Yeah, listen, we're human beings, and, you know, we're by and large, we're idiots. You know, but we are. We're deeply unsophisticated, you know, and the world changes at such speed. And, you know, most people can't process it. Why on earth would you think they could? Most people get up in the morning and they think about their family and they think about their job and they think about coming home that night and they think about their safety and security. That's what they think about. Mm-hmm. And if they spend any time thinking about other stuff, it's really not long. And that's what human beings are. It doesn't make them selfish or stupid. That's what people are. And those are the people you need to come bring onto your side.
Can I just take you back to interactive TV? There was a big thing about 10 years ago where everyone was talking about South Korea and how they are interacting on a nightly basis with games via TV, via their high-speed cable networks or something, whatever it was. We got caught up in that way of thinking, didn't we? Was that actually happening in South Korea, would you know? And have we changed now from not wanting to interact with the public in that way anymore?
I think in terms of television has been usurped by a certain generation. People always talk about Netflix and this, that, the other. It's meaningless when you compare it to games. You know, games have usurped television for that generation. And I said years ago at Endemol, you know what, eventually we're going to have to make TV shows that people play rather than they watch.
Right.
And, you know, you can't do it as a truth. You have to start as a game and be a game. You know, my son doesn't watch a lot of linear telly. He plays a lot of games. And South Korea, you know, is a huge industry, gaming over there, and online gaming and, you know, competitive gaming and ex-gaming. And, you know, that's what the South Koreans were doing. You know, they got a huge game culture. No one's ever really done that interactive TV thing very well. You know, we vote on television shows, but really, I mean, that's like sending in a postcard for Sports Personality of the Year. It's the same thing. It's just we're literally voting in a different way. We're not interacting. And every couple of years, someone goes, oh, we've had this amazing idea, and it's a drama, but you decide what happens, and like no one's ever thought of it before. And you think, well, people think of it literally all the time, and they launch it, and it's not interesting, because there's people out there who are unbelievably good at writing drama. So why not let them write it rather than a 15-year-old kid? You know, TV does drama much better than the internet. It does documentaries much better than the internet. And so those things thrive. Entertainment, it by and large, is done better on the internet. You know, if you want a quick fix, if you want a little bit of jeopardy, a bit of humor, stuff like that, you know, that's where the internet comes into its own. And that's the bit of television that's sort of taken a hit, is entertainment and family entertainment and stuff like that. You know, that's the tricky area for us.
So where do you see the future of that going then?
Well, you know, entertainment has to be. Oh God, I bang the drum about this at Endemol; they get so bored.
It's actually your role at Endemol.
Yeah, no. What's my role? Well, it's. I mean, it's. I sort of have to kind of think about what's the next generation of shows, but I've always been quite entertainment based. And so we've got drama companies who I'd have nothing to do with. We've got documentary companies who do amazing things. And the money they're bringing in at the moment is huge, because drama is massive because of Netflix and all sorts. Mm. And entertainment is sort of slightly moribund at the moment. And, you know, we're fortunate to have lots of big brands in entertainment, which continue to do well, but it's hard to get new business in entertainment telly. And so my job is to say to them, look, we have to think differently about what entertainment is. We have to think differently how we deliver it to people, and it has to come, it has to be platform neutral. You know, it has to be that we'll make stuff for any platform. You know, it really does. And listen, I will never not be in love with television, and my end goal will always be, oh, we made this thing and it was huge on YouTube and made us a fortune, but then we sold a TV pilot of it, so I'm really excited. And, you know, and that will always be the way I think. But people are crazy for content. There's never been a better time to be an ideas person or a content maker or anything like that. But it's we're in a transitional period at the moment, and you just got to make sure that you think like a startup. You got to think like a couple of 21-year-olds who want to film something, you know, in a back room. And, you know, if you do that, then you'll stay on top of the business, I think.
Are viewing figures dwindling?
Not massively, actually. Is I mean, there are two sort of you know, people often talk about, firstly, viewing figures going down a lot, which obviously from the 80s they have done, but actually they're holding fairly firm now. And also people say, oh, but everyone just watches whenever they want, don't they? They don't watch when shows go out. You think, yeah, like 85% of them do. I mean, really, most people watch a show when it goes out and, you know, sit down and watch the adverts, and then, you know, and that's not going to last forever. But at the moment, that's definitely lasting. And, you know, so I think people overestimate the pace of change in television. You know, there's still a huge, you know, look at Pointless and The Chase, which are two shows that are on at tea time. You know, so no one is watching those on catch up, and a few people are, but it's not big catch up material. And, you know, you've got, like yesterday, 8 million people at 5:15 watching television at the same time, at 5:15 watching quizzes. And those shows have been on for 8 years against each other. Now, if you had a YouTube video that had 8 million viewers, people would go crazy. It would be like the biggest sensation. If you go, oh, they've got 8 million views. Well, they're doing it every day with these two formats, and with everybody watching. And not only, everyone's watching at the same time. You know, that's still a huge deal.
Yeah, it is. 8 million, who wins that?
It is, well, if it's pretty much identical. They add on plus one, because they got a plus one channel and BBC don't, so they're ahead with plus one added on. But if you just do actually head to head, it's hilariously identical, and has been for a really, really long time. It's so lovely. It's like kind of North Korea and South Korea. It's this state of kind of, you know, it's very weird. It's like, you know, Blur Oasis did so good for both of them. You know, they both sold far more records than they would have done, and that's it. And we record in the studio next to them as well. So the Chaser next door, and then there's us.
Yeah.
And Bradley, who I love and I've worked with loads, because they don't have an audience on the Chase, and we do. So he's always coming whenever he's bored, which is, if you know Bradley, is a lot.
Yes.
He just comes into our studio and sort of sits down and chats to the audience and all that. So we're all very close, and lots of people go between the two shows.
Hold on, you film in the same place?
Yeah, literally next door to each other. We're Studio 8, they're Studio 9 up at Elstree.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So there was literally a wall between the two of them. We should call that wall BBC Two, because that is essentially what it is.
You couldn't give Bradley an audience. That show would be totally different.
Don't. I mean, if perform. Yeah, I mean, he's and also if he ever turns up on our set, you just think, oh God, that's half an hour gone. You know? Which, when you're doing four a day, you know, you can't. But yeah, I think people underestimate with television quite how many people are still watching and what that means.
Though they watch at, I think, certain times, like Sunday morning, I think I'm all right at the moment. I think I'm safe, that our ratings are all right. And because people get up on Sunday morning, they go out, they do their stuff for their kids. But the people who put on the TV don't go, I'm going to sit and watch On Demand. I'm going to watch Breaking Bad or something, or The Crown.
Yeah.
It's not that time of day. And I think that's the same with, you know, your slots.
It's a routine thing. You know, you sort of wake up, you think, oh, brilliant, I'll put that on because I'm waking up in the morning. There's certain bits of the day where television really comes into its own. Coming home from work is one. Waking up on a Sunday morning is one. And, you know, I know I've been on Sunday brunch, and it's so weird, Twitter, because you instantly tell what shows people engage with. So if you're on Sunday brunch, loads of people tweet you.
Right.
You know, and ask you stuff about what happened on Sunday brunch, or say, oh, so you said this, blah, 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 on Sunday brunch. And sometimes you go on shows and
Nothing.
Right. And you know, it's I find that very interesting. You get it's you know, I love in telly, you get overnights every morning, which is break 5 minute breakdowns of every single person who's watched every single TV show the day before, which for me is heaven. So you see exactly who's watching what shows are going up, what shows are going down, what shows compete against each other, what shows lost audience halfway through, what shows started gaining audience, which is very rare. And so you know, I love that sort of thing. But Twitter adds an extra element to that, which is you get that sort of engagement thing of a show where you just think, oh well, I thought that radio show only had 100,000 listeners, but people keep asking me about it, and you know, so it's qualitative data to go with the quantitative data, which I've run my life by.
But it's dangerous doing that, because there's been so many cases in history. I think only Fours and Horses mm-hmm. didn't rate in the first series.
Yeah.
If you chase ratings, you're going to end up with bland, same TV, aren't
yeah.
you? You have to, you know, you have to look for something different, something original every now and then.
Which no, I agree.
I believe the young ones didn't rate at all, did it, on the first episode or
no,
something?
Loads of things. I mean, you know, those olden days were full of things saying it wasn't until series 11 when people started watching. Like Generation Game, I think I was watching a thing. They said, anyway, we got through to series 7 and then ITV went on strike, so we were literally the only thing on. And after that, people started watching. I think blind. But actually, TV executives, for you know, they get a bad press. They're very good at sticking with things. There's very, very few things, very few sitcoms that won't get two series. I mean, very few. And, you know, but these, you know, it's hard. If you're making stuff like sitcoms, which don't rate particularly well at the moment, and they're very expensive, you know, but they do back them, you know. They put them on again and again and again. But yeah, listen, originality is hard. But then when something is genuinely original, and I would controversially say Mrs. Brown's Boys is very original, because I love that show. Yeah, and it was a stage show which they'd done absolutely honed their craft over years and years and years. I remember watching the first one and just going, "That's a hit." Because
really, you
know, oh, just a huge. I texted the commissioner. I just said, "You're going to get in such grief tomorrow." But I thought that was great, because you know, it's different. He breaks the fourth wall.
Yeah.
It's different comedy. And people who say, people talk about Mrs. Brown's Boys, say it's awful. You think, right, I'll tell you what, it's not awful. It's the most successful version of the thing that you hate. Right, and that's because it's good. You know, you don't snag off 15 other shows because no one watched them because they weren't good. That show is brilliant, which is why people watch it.
You know what happened to me is I put it on one day by mistake. I thought, this isn't for me. I put it on by mistake, and it was on in the background. And I started just seeing them break the fourth wall, as you say. And I just saw everyone laughing all the time. I was like, this is really nice. It's not miserable at all. It's really up and happy. And I've been addicted to it ever since.
And it is.
Absolutely love it.
And it's because, you know, this guy, Brendan, taught it for 10 years. So he knows what an audience wants.
And he knows what he's doing.
And, you know, to be fair to the BBC, you know, that's a risk to put that on, because you know people are going to snag you off. You know what people are going to say about that show, but they did it anyway, and it's been an enormous hit for them.
What do you think about Netflix refusing to release their ratings, even though they know them? They're saying, we're not doing that.
Yeah, great.
Yeah, but you'd hate that, wouldn't you?
Well, as a nerd, I'd hate it. But as a program maker, I would love it. Because you just think, well, the pressure is taken off. You know, instantly, you know, those overnights there are, especially for dramas and stuff like that, where you probably do have one shot at it. You know, if the overnights are coming in and they're not big, you know, it's difficult. It's demotivating for everyone. You know, if you've got to write another series and people are suddenly going, it was only 2.8 million though, and the thing last week got 5 million. Whereas Netflix, you know, it's just much more freeing. You can just listen to what people think about it. And so long as your paymasters, which is Netflix, as long as they're happy, you know, because if they're not happy, you know, you'll know if your ratings are bad, because they won't ask you to do another series because it costs a lot of money. So you just think, well, my ratings are clearly good enough because they're doing it again, and the feedback is great, and what people are writing about it is great. No, I would, as a producer, I would love that. I would miss the overnights, but
I hear that sport is taking a hit recently. Live sport has been declining, and I spoke to somebody at. Is that true, by the way? Do you know?
It's interesting. If you put it on terrestrial television, it does better than anything else on terrestrial television, which is, I mean, I guess like for like, it's doing worse. But if you put a FA Cup match on Friday night on BBC Two, it's amazing for them.
Someone told me that the big matches are still, let's take football, for example. Football dominates, by the way. All the other sports hardly rate at all. They don't rate that much at all. Ashes and things, big events like that do. But as the ratings are dropping, someone told me they think it's because if you put on, say, a Netflix drama of some description, you're guaranteed entertainment.
Yeah.
Sport, you're never guaranteed. And they're saying that they're finding more couples and the traditional guy would sit down and say, I want to watch the football. Yeah, yeah. They're going, actually, I quite like Netflix as well because it appeals to, yeah, to everybody in the household. Is this true? Or
yeah, I think I would buy that. And I think, you know, it's interesting that sports still does well on terrestrial TV, still does really well. And Match of the Day, it's interesting. As everything sort of recedes slightly in terms of ratings, Match of the Day stayed where it is.
Brilliant.
So, yeah. you know, it gets kind of 3.5 million, occasionally 4 million on a Saturday night, which at 10:30 is huge.
Good, yeah.
And, you know, as I say, if you put a live football match or you put the, you know, the Women's World Cup and stuff like that, really, really big ratings, you know, which are great for terrestrial telly. You know, it's more the pay TV model that's tricky. And yeah, I hadn't heard that theory before, but that makes a lot of sense to me, because, you know, sport is drama. That's the point, isn't it? Sport is soap opera.
Yeah.
You know, that's all it is. And if you've got a more expensive, better written one, then I can see that. But then, you know, look at sports like snooker. You know, anything that can deliver you kind of 10 hours of content a day, you don't need to get huge ratings, is the truth, because, you know, you've got, so snooker is literally never off the screens now. You know, Eurosport can, you know, show it almost nonstop. And, you know, that's good business for everybody because it's not expensive. And, you know, if you've got 40, 50, 60,000 people watching it, you know, going up to 100,000 for a final, it's fine. Everyone's happy with that. But yeah, I think probably the big marquee football matches are not rating what they once were.
I couldn't believe no one took the Chess last time they had that big match, Carson versus... Oh, God, the guy slips my memory. It was being watched by billions in the world. No one picked it up over here. And I thought, it's got to be the cheapest telly in the world. They're just sitting playing chess for hours on end.
I mean, it's pretty easy to stream, you would think. And
well, that's the streaming was amazing. Yeah, yeah. I mean, but no one picked up on one of the channels. I was thinking, hey, you've got to pick that up. It's just cheap and it's dramatic.
I mean, that's the thing. You know, it doesn't cost a huge amount to run a channel. I mean, you've got bandwidth and, you know, you've got your license and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, if you can, you know, that's why stuff like, you know, chess would be perfect. Snooker is perfect. Cricket is kind of good, except it's too expensive now and it's hard to cover. But anything that, yeah, anything where it's played on a desktop, you know, you just think, well, this is fantastic. You know, you watch the links in the snooker, and, you know, they're in such a tiny room, and they're not dressed up; they're just sort of chatting. Yeah. And actually, it's more appealing to watch, is the truth, when it's not super slick and it's cheaper. And you think, well, that, you know, that makes sense for everybody.
I've got lots of theories on sport. I think I've spent so much time around it. I won't do it now. I won't bore you up.
Oh, no, you can do. I've got loads of theories on sport.
Have you?
I want to reinvent the rules of tennis.
Do you? To what? One serve?
No, first to four in each set, first to five sets. So you're playing the same amount of games, but there's more Jeopardy games, which is, that's what you want. Darts works brilliantly because it's always Jeopardy. You're getting Jeopardy every 20, 30, 45 seconds in darts, you know, and hitting a double endlessly, or, you know, and you play, you know, three legs in a set, and, you know, every single time, you know, constantly winning a set. So if you play first to four in tennis, you would get three or four times more exciting points in the same amount of games than you do in first to six. People don't buy this at all, but it happens to be true.
Well, all right, let's go let's go into that a bit, because I've got some theories on TV shows totally, which is basically humans like watching humans, and they like watching emotion.
Yeah.
I've always said, when I was at Sky Sports when they got the F1, I said, you've got to try and get away that you can get. I find the whole thing so boring because I'm just watching a bit of metal going around the track. You've got to find a way that you can get there. Their helmets to be transparent, so I can
transparent
see,
helmets,
so that's, I can see, so I can see some emotion, or get them not to wear them. But I can't see, but I can't see any emotion on these guys' faces. I don't know. It could be anyone in the car. I know nothing.
Yeah.
So I was going. I kept on going to the guys. They ignore me, by the way. I kept on going. Can you just cut to the pit a bit more? Because there's emotions going on in the pit, and I want to see humans and see what's going on. I don't know who's doing well and who's not. I can't because the car. You know, because we don't. I don't know enough about the cars and everything. When you look at darts. People love darts. Yeah. They love because they face the pressure. They can't hide the pressure.
I mean, if you look at this, because you're exactly right. I was thinking about this the other day about Sports Personality of the Year, and this guy Adam Peaty, who's been nominated the last 4 years, by any stretch of the imagination, one of the greatest sports people that Britain have ever had. You know, he's so far above everyone else in his event. You know, he's winning these 50-meter races by miles. I mean, he's, you know, world. He's got the 10 best times in the world in kind of both his events. But it's swimming and you can't see them.
Can't see their faces.
You can't see the faces. So no one really, people wouldn't pick him out of a lineup.
Yeah.
You know, and they certainly couldn't see that it's hard for him or that he, you know.
So I also used to say to all the sports directors, the football directors, they all
hated. They must have loved you. Here to go. As well, yeah. Tim's in the gallery again.
But the two things they did in the, which I loved, I mean, in Spanish football, they film it a lot wider, which is why I love, because I'd rather see the game. But the other thing, if you ever watch, you'll notice now they do that. And the other thing they do is when they do a penalty, say, I don't know, Ronaldo's taking a penalty or something, they'll cut to Ronaldo's face, they'll cut to the keeper, they'll cut to Ronaldo. It's like out of a spaghetti western. Yeah, yeah, yeah. But it's like because they're showing them motion, the build-up, we seem to be cutting around all over the shop, and it's like get to the faces only on that bit, because you know, but it's important to see the,
I think that's exactly right. You look at the Ryder Cup, and we love the Ryder Cup because I mean you see faces in golf but not so, but in the Ryder Cup you've always got the four teammates on the golf cart, and you literally, and you can go right in on them, and you know, and you just see it, and you see it much, much, much more exciting because you think people care about it.
That is true, and in boxing, that's one way. I really don't like watching boxing because I don't like watching people get beaten up. But you get, as soon as you watch it, you get drawn in.
Because
it's literally human beings that they're sort of. Best stroke, worst.
Oh, good. And
when they're fighting for their lives.
Yeah. And when they sort of face each other in the ring for the first time, you're just looking, looking into the eyes.
Or
right?
UFC. It's like, this is really, you know, this is proper nature. Now, apart from, but I think this goes for all TV shows, apart from The Blue Planet, which obviously got a lot of animals in it.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, too many.
But your show, let's take that Pointless, for instance. That's one where it's all about the people. It's Alexander having a little, you know, where he does his little chat to himself. And thinking, and then you do your good lines to people, and you know, and you're supportive of the people as well. You're not putting them down, and then they're having a little think, and they're not sure. It's we like watching humans, don't we?
You know, and you know what? I think one of the things about Pointless that never gets, because I do try and think about it as a producer sometimes. I think having pairs of contestants is really important.
Yes.
I think as soon as you have an individual contestant, you kind of go, and you're from Daventry. I say, well, that's fine. As soon as you've got a pair, if it's like, you know, they're married, you kind of think, oh, really?
Yeah.
Or had a, blimey, how did, you know, or if it's father and daughter, you just think, oh God, I hope it goes all right for her because it's her dad and, you know, he wants to look good in front of her. And, you know, sometimes you have like mother-in-law and son-in-law and you just think, or you get two people who work together, one of whom's the boss. And we have far more immediate opinions about pairs than we do about individuals, I think. And I think immediately people can find a way in when you've got a pair on telly. And it's the same with hosting, and you'll know this. If you host in a pair, you're just hosting as an individual is really, it's quite haunting, is the truth. Because who are you talking to?
Yeah.
If you know what I mean. You know, what are you if you're not a salesman, if you're hosting by yourself? That's all you are, right?
Right.
That's all you are.
Yep.
Whereas if you're hosting with a friend, you know, you are having a conversation with a friend and people are watching, and isn't that nice? And I just think it's so completely different. And I don't think it's any coincidence that all the big shows now are hosted by duos, which didn't used to be the case. You know, and you got Strictly as a duo, Bake Off is a duo, all the Ant and Dec stuff is duos. You look at Sunday Brunch, it's a duo. And it's just, it's so much more human and humanizing because you've got, just you're not being sold to all the time.
Though I suppose the trend on YouTube is individuals, and I suppose they become your friend.
Yeah.
That's the beauty of it. There's one person talking to you. And, you know, I've discussed this before on the podcast. A lot of people in my industry hate YouTubers. I think they're amazing. They sit there talking to one person down a camera about their lives, if they're a vlogger or trying to sell their product, whatever they're doing. And I think it's a real talent.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's psychologically quite unhealthy, is the truth, because I do think they're giving too much of themselves.
Yeah.
Is the truth. And it's like being in a boy band. I think it's like being in a boy band in the 70s or something.
There's a trade-off. Yeah. They might earn $3 million a year. But yeah, they're going to maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. And listen, so long as they know, so long as they're comfortable with that. But yeah, you know, the camera can steal your soul if you're giving away too much of yourself. And, you know, I see that in those YouTubers. But, you know, it's again, you know, the pairs of YouTubers, it's kind of more fun. You know, they're the ones where you just think, oh, okay, there's something here. Yeah. And there's a bit of back and forth and different personalities. Mm. And that's why YouTubers quite often appear on each other's channels. And it's because they sort of know, I can't do another 20 minutes to camera. I just can't, you know, I just don't, please, God, don't make me. I know I've just been to the dentist. I don't feel amazing. I know I've got a thing tomorrow where I've got to be up early to do a corporate and I don't want to do it. And I've got a smile for 20 minutes. At least if I get my friend Marcus along, you know, he can ask me a question.
I was at a wedding with Joe Suggs recently and Thatch Joe, and he was, he's such a lovely bloke. I really like him. And though he had his camera on nonstop, his phone, and he could. He loved it, by the way, and he was really enjoying himself. But I thought, I just feel sorry for you because I'm sitting here having a really good time, and you're having to film yourself non-stop.
I mean, if your life is your product, it's difficult. Mm. And you see that with lots of, you've always seen that with starlets and stuff like that, where it's, listen, your life and your lifestyle is the thing that's being sold. Then, you know, there is a trade-off. And I always think if you can do a TV show and be yourself, which you obviously do, and I try and do, at least there's a safety valve there. And at least if someone asks you to do something you don't want to do, you just say, no, listen, it's not for me today. Yeah. You know, I'm not going to do it. You just do something that you're comfortable with. And, I do worry about that generation of YouTubers. But, I mean, also, God, good luck to them with the money they're raking in. But, you know, I mean, it's good. They found them. Yeah, they really are. We just did a big live tour with some YouTubers. And it's amazing. You know, it's incredible. It's a phenomenon. But a phenomenon in the same way that, you know, basically Rollers and Bros were a phenomenon.
You think they'll go the same way as that, do you? Can I talk about the controversial thing? BBC, the mm-hmm. thing that comes up a lot, the license fee.
Yeah.
I know for a fact, we all know for a fact, if you stick your TV show on BBC, you're going to get ratings. It's moving slightly away from that now, I believe. I've got Sky Q now.
Yeah.
And so have you got Sky Q? Because when you turn it on, you now get pictures. So it's gone away from that usual 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. You now end up with pictures. Yeah. So like my youngest daughter will point at a picture what she wants or something. Yeah. Says, I want that one. So it's no longer.
She's 19, bless her.
When we did something for the weekend, we just had ratings from day one, more or less. They wanted 200,000 and we went way over that.
Yeah.
When we moved to Channel 4, it's a completely different show, by the way, but when we did move to Channel 4, suddenly we had to work. I mean, I love it over there, but we had to work a bit harder for the ratings.
Yeah.
People still do 1 and 2. Can they keep with the license fee, though?
Well, it's interesting. Well, 1 and 3, I always remember at my nan's house, the 1 and 3 were always, on the remote control, those numbers had disappeared.
Yes.
And 2 and 4 were pristine. I think, listen, I've always thought about the BBC. It's difficult for me to say because obviously I do a show for the BBC. I do much more for other channels, and obviously in my role at Endemol, you know, most of my money comes from pay broadcasters, you know, whether it's Sky or whether it's, you know, the American broadcasters. So almost all of my money comes from outside the BBC, but I recognise publicly people would see that I'm paid by the BBC. You know, we sell shows everywhere in the world, is the truth, as Endemol, everywhere in the world. And there is not a better, healthier, more competitive TV market anywhere in the world than Britain.
Right.
Right. Now, there could be a number of reasons for that. You know, perhaps Britons are innately more creative than other people, you know, amazing at music and all that kind of stuff. Personally, I believe that the BBC is one of the main reasons why our television industry is so impressive and so varied, and we've got such extraordinary telly, and we export so much, and you know, it raises such a huge amount of money. I think the BBC is important to that. I think that the BBC, if it just came out of our tax money, it would be slightly different, but because we are asked to pay for it separately as a license, I think people think of it slightly differently than the way that they would think about other essential services. And I honestly think that having a very healthy broadcast sector, radio, television, stuff like that, is an essential service. I think it's crazy to think it's not. If I think of any one of my nan's generation, anyone, there's this box in the corner of their room, you know, and most people, you know, if you don't have any money, you know, this box is unbelievable. The stuff that you can see on it and get on it on Blue Planet and stuff, the stuff that would disappear in a heartbeat if there wasn't a publicly funded broadcaster. I think, you know, it's a weird thing. And, you know, we're supposed to believe in a free market and all this kind of stuff. And, I can see that. But sometimes you're allowed to buck the market. Sometimes you're allowed to say, as human beings, in the same way that we've got a health service, why don't we have an entertainment service? Why don't we forget this idea that entertainment is a frippery and understand it's really, really important to people, especially people by themselves. It's really, really important. And I think it's something worth paying for.
Okay, I don't want to say this because I want to work for the BBC again. But isn't it a compulsory tax?
But everything's a compulsory tax. I mean,
I don't have to watch ITV.
Because it's a separate license. If they just said, no, we're going to pay for it out of normal income tax, then you wouldn't say it's a compulsory. I mean, the NHS is a compulsory tax. You know, if you go private, which you're very welcome to do, you still have to pay for the NHS, okay? I don't drive. I still have to pay for the roads, okay? And I'm fine to do it because I'm a human being who lives in a society. Yeah. And I think that you can absolutely disagree that that's something you want your tax paid on. Yeah. Absolutely can. And when you get to the point where a huge majority of people agree that it's something they don't want their tax to be paid on, we will stop paying our... You know, lots of people don't want to pay for nuclear weapons, but we kind of go, enough people still go, actually, I think it still is a good idea. And, you know, that's what a society is.
So we need a referendum.
Can you imagine? Can you imagine such a thing?
Hey, vote Tim and you get a referendum.
I know
the BBC.
I do know.
But the papers are gunning for them now, aren't they? There's a lot of powerful papers who don't want the BBC around.
Of course
around
they don't,
anymore.
Because they're direct competitors.
Right. So,
which is
yeah, but the public don't
fine.
Know that. The public just think they're informing them.
But so. You know, in the same way that you know, lots of private healthcare providers will lobby the government for you know, outsourcing bits of the NHS. Mm. You know, that's the world that we live in.
But how many countries have the BBC? I mean, I'm a state-run TV. Russia, maybe, and
yeah,
China.
There are lots of places that do. There are lots of places that do. There are, you know, and places like America obviously have it as you know, a very small version of it. You know, we've got one of the healthiest, certainly one of the best. Listen, in a lot of countries, a state-controlled media is to support the government.
Yeah.
We're very, very unusual in having state-controlled media. Whatever people think that is not run by the government is not necessarily biased against one wing or the other. You know, it's fine for people to say it is, but it's... Half the people on the left say it's biased against the left. Half the people on the right say it's biased against on the right. I'm sure there's a little bit of truth in both because it's run by human beings. But it's a very rare thing that we have, and it's a very precious thing that we have. And I'm not the person to fight for it because I am on their payroll at times, is the truth. Despite the fact that that's really not where my money comes from, I am not the person who can have that fight. I definitely think there's stuff they could do less of. That's definitely true. You see that sign sometimes that says, oh, this is what the BBC did in the 80s, and it's BBC One, BBC Two, and the four radio stations. This is what we do now for less money, and it's like these 50 different things. And you just think, yeah, that's just because you overspent, I suspect, in the 80s, because, you know, I think you're doing enough. And, you know, the BBC, they pay a huge amount less than ITV or Channel 4.
It's interesting because you quoted David Attenborough there. It's always the same thing comes up. David Attenborough... news, drama, whenever you talk about the BBC license fee. And David Attenborough, that's one show a year. Drama, I think the biggest selling BBC drama ever was Downton Abbey, which was not made by the BBC. They sell programmes abroad as well. So other people can make dramas. And the news, well, there's ITV News and Channel 4 News and everything else. So there are different news. I would say the argument's more about the radio. I mean, the radio.
Extraordinary.
And you talk about the little old lady sitting there. The radio is the friend for her. Our radio is unbelievable. And one of the reasons, apparently, podcasts aren't working so well over here as they are in America... boo the BBC, is because our radio stations are so good. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So all six of them and all the other ones which are free as well.
Yeah.
Free radio.
And local radio.
No advertising. Mm. Bam. You've got great radio stations. And I think it's worth the license fee just for that.
Yeah,
but
of course.
People don't bring this up a lot.
There are so many different things that are worth the license fee alone, is the truth. And, you know, everyone's got one. Everyone's got different ones. And listen, one day it will go away. And, you know, I think we'll be a poorer country for it. But it's, as I say, I'm not someone who can go to the barricades for that because, you know, I have a vested interest. I understand that. But I do. I think it would be a terrible shame. And I do think it's pernicious sometimes when people who have a direct commercial interest in the BBC not existing are allowed, constantly to sort of bang in that drum without ever saying at any point, oh, by the way, this would make us countless millions if it did, you know, break down. It would make countless millions for about 20 shareholders, just so you know.
Yeah.
Just so you know. And then, which, by the way, is fine. We live in a capitalist world. But never, ever, ever kid yourself that that's not the argument that's being had.
Down with capitalism. It doesn't work. that's for another podcast.
That's good.
I'm going to get you back into
Down with
about,
capitalism. Yeah.
I'm going to get you into talk about global politics one day.
Mm.
Let's talk about you and your history. So you grew up and went to a normal school and ended up at Cambridge. Is that kind of where I went?
A good comprehensive school boy. Yeah, I went to Cambridge. I'm very surprised to find myself at Cambridge, which I thought would be super posh and full of people I hated, and I was quite surprised. I thought, well, at least I've got a chip on my shoulder about my upbringing. You turn up there, you think, oh God, no one, these people went to these nice schools and they're rich, but also they're just really nice, decent human beings. It's quite hard to keep that chip on your shoulder. I've always kept it, by the way. I really have. And, you know, we write privilege out of history sometimes. And some of the people you see around you, you just think the stuff you've got that you take for granted that you didn't earn. I find, you know, when I think about how hard I've worked and, you know, what I've earned, and then people who are born into it who have the same thing, you know, I find extraordinary. And when we live in such an unequal society, you know, I find it extraordinary. And people who haven't really earned their money and then still won't pay tax, you think, come on.
Oh,
I mean, come on.
There's your capitalist society, you know, for you.
But
Richard,
it's so, I will never lose the chip on my shoulder. But at the same time, I have to accept that lots of people who I know who were born very rich are deeply kind, lovely, clever, funny human beings.
What was it like there?
It was great. I loved it. I mean, it was you know, it's extraordinary. It was so different to my school, which was a sort of 1970s comp, it was amazing. It was kind of magical. And as with anyone who's been to any sort of uni or anything like that, it's, you know, you meet people who are friends for the rest of your life, and you know, that's definitely the case. And I'm still in, you know, some of my best friends are still people I met from then. And you have 3 years of just sort of, it's an extraordinary experience. You know, academically, I'm not, it's really not my strength, I have to say. I'm not particularly good academically. I can get through exams and stuff because I know what to do and what to say, but my brain, the capacity of my brain to understand philosophy and stuff like that, I can't do it.
What were you studying? Politics and philosophy?
Sociology and politics, yeah. So there was a bit of philosophy and stuff.
What was your dream then?
To be a writer, really. I wanted to be a sports writer, was my thing. And I had never even thought about television, even though that is actually the thing that I loved throughout my entire childhood. And I got a job in telly and I thought, how thick are you that you spent 5 years wanting to be a sports writer when the thing you loved? I think because I didn't know anyone who worked in telly. I didn't really know that job existed. Didn't really think about people making that stuff. And the second I found out that people did, I thought, okay, this is me. And I haven't had a day off since. But I wanted to be a
something
a
magical
writer.
About TV, isn't it?
You know what? It was my friend throughout childhood and remains so today. And it's, I love it. I'm very lucky.
Well, we were lucky because we came along at the time when TV exploded. So they needed to take on
a
lot of staff.
Oh my goodness, early 90s, it was amazing.
I didn't have an education really. I went to you know, the normal comprehensive school and got some O-levels and then started jobbing my way around.
O-levels, same.
And just thought, well, I'm going to go and work in television. I was going, no, you're not. And I'm like, yes, I am. And then I've ended up in TV. But yeah. I think it was a very closed shop when I first entered. It very much was university based,
yeah,
the big universities especially were attracted into it, and it started opening up to everybody.
No, I'm the same. I was very lucky. It was like sort of 92 or something, and it was just when, you know, Sky had started commissioning things and some of the smaller channels, so there was no budget, so they had to employ people who were happy, you know, who just didn't, you know, back in those days we used to get housing benefit and stuff like that, so we could move to London and, you know, support ourselves for a couple of months till we got a job. But yeah, suddenly it was open to people who would never have got a job in telly before, which was amazing.
Always the problem with TV is you don't really need any qualifications, do you? No. You just need ideas.
Yeah, you just need to be good. That's I always say about all these things, writing, telly, is actually the easiest job in the world to get into, because if you're great, honestly, please just come, you know, come. We run an intern scheme every year at End of Honor. We make sure we get people who've never worked in telly before and try and find people from different areas and really, really sort of broaden the appeal. And the second you get these people down for an away day and they're sort of room for the people, someone will say something, you think, yep, we'll have her, that's great. And, you know, the amount of people I've done that with who are now kind of running Channel 4 or have got multi-million pound companies, just because they came along, they sat in a room, they said something that made me think, right, you love television, you understand why you love television, and you've got ideas about how to make it. And it's you can't fake it.
I often can't believe I'm getting paid. I mean, I know that's such a cliche thing to say.
I don't think you're the only one to.
I know. I'll read my Twitter feed. So why is it that people... I'm intrigued by the Cambridge-Oxford thing. They all end up in... Not they all, sorry. That's absolutely nonsense. But lots of them end up in the entertainment industry. Yeah. I always think it's quite a weird thing to do if you go somewhere so academic to end up in our industry.
Well, I think there's lots of people there like me who you know, you get good exam results, but you're not particularly academic. You know, some of the brightest people I know are people I was at Cambridge with who are now academics. Right, so my friend Alan, who did the same course as me, and is now he's a professor at the University of East Anglia into media and culture. Now, he is clever, right? You know, culturally, we like to have clever people on television, and people would think I'm clever. You think, you know what? This guy is clever. This guy sees the world from underneath. You know, he sees how it all fits together. You know, if he ever tweets something, I'll read it. You just go, oh, now I get it. Now I understand. Everyone's hot take from the newspapers, you think, fine. Alan will say something, you think, I see how it fits together now. I get it. So he's clever. But there's a whole lot of other people who are just sort of quite bright. But, you know, and lots of funny people are quite bright and vice versa. And, you know, they end up in telly. You get, you know, all the kind of footlights type people end up on telly, and people like Xander ends up on telly. And I just think that, you know, if you've got an inquiring mind, but you're not academic, or you're not going to be an academic, then telly is quite... Lots of people go into the city.
He doesn't want to be on telly, does he?
Xander.
No, he wants to be running the classical music industry, doesn't he?
He wants to sing. Xander, you know, Xander is the most enthusiastic person in the world, is the truth. And he loves doing what, you know, and he doesn't have a cynical bone in his body, which is why I adore him. And you know, people will say to him, do you want to do an album, or, you know, or do you want to do a panel show on ITV? And they just go, oh my God, that sounds amazing. Yes. And it's genuine, so deeply genuine. And I love his attitude towards life. It's not my attitude towards life. people going to law, people going to medicine, and the rest of us, what are you going to do? And this is if you can get into the media or into telly especially, it's just a joy, right?
I was only joking about him, by the way. He's a great guest. Whenever he comes on the show, we're like, you know,
lovely.
Yeah, when you get guests like that, you go, oh, brilliant, because he can just talk and he's entertaining. He's always got a great story. Were you in Footlights or the other one?
I didn't when I was at Cambridge. I'm quite shy, I'm quite introverted, so I didn't really move outside of my circle. Some people go to like Oxford or Cambridge and they make just every use of every single second, and they join all the clubs and they meet everybody, and I just didn't. I sat around with my friends and drank and just enjoyed myself, but I kept, you know, I'd always watching, but I never really joined in, and you know, I never really do. So no, I didn't do any of that stuff. But Xander was in Footlights when I was there, as was Ben Miller. And, you know, I think a few years after, there's like Sacha Baron Cohen and David Mitchell and Robert Webb and people like that. But no, I'm not a joiner in a...
You're shy.
Oh, yeah.
Can I ask that very awkward, horrible question and the cliche question? You're so tall.
Yes.
When you were coming on Sunday brunch, we made a conscious decision not to ask you about it. Because we just thought you must get so bored of talking about it. But if you are shy, it makes you... How tall are you?
6'7".
Must be. Well, I see you walking around where we live, around here, West London, and you just—it's hard to hide.
Oh, it's impossible to hide. it's literally impossible to hide, and it's a weird one. But then it always was impossible to hide, and yeah, it's awkward. And my son is very tall as well, and he's very like me, and so I sit and chat to him about it a lot. And I said, look, you've got two. There's only two options you have when you walk in a room. There's only two reactions. One is going to be, who's that tall guy? And the other one is going to be, who's that tall guy looking awkward about being tall? So those, you don't have the option of who's that normal size guy. It just doesn't exist for you. And, you know, there's a million problems you can have in your life. And this one is, this is your cross to bear, you know, and there are worse ones. And I said, that's all it is. But yeah, if you are self-conscious, it's very annoying being 6'7". But, you know, in terms of... because I get recognised a lot now as well, so the height is less of an issue, I think. But yeah, sometimes it's weird because these days, if I am somewhere I don't want to be recognised, if I'm in a hurry or something, I take my glasses off, and it's quite a good disguise not having my glasses on, is the truth. But then sometimes when I take my glasses off, I remember that I'm just sort of like a really massively tall guy again, you know. And you think, of course, now people are not looking at you; they're just going, "Oh God, that guy's tall, isn't it?" And it's weird because it reminds me of the self consciousness which I've lost a lot of. But yeah, there's no goodness me. Yeah, if you're shy, don't be 6'7". I wouldn't recommend it.
Yeah, it's funny that, isn't it? It's one of those things that you're burdened, if that's the right word, with for the whole of your life.
Well, it's why I really, really, really empathise when people talk about microaggression, which they talk about a lot with identity politics now. You know, in terms of race, in terms of gender, in terms of sexuality, they say, look, it's microaggressions. It's all day, every day, just something reminding you all the time. And you know, I have that with height, which is not a huge deal. It's nothing compared to those things, but it does mean I know what you mean. I know that 50 times a day, someone reminds you about the thing that others you and that makes you a different human being. So I said, look, if you need me to fight for you, I'll fight for you. Because I'm fine. I'll live with it. But I get microaggressions. I really understand it.
Do you know what my one was? And you're going to think, I'm not belittling you, by the way, here. Excuse the... But mine was my surname. I had a brother who was very, very shy. And from the age of 11, I was probably... About the age of 11, I was called Love Gay.
Right.
And
I mean, it's
you laughed, Richard.
It's wordplay, isn't it?
You laughed, but can you imagine being an 11-year-old boy?
Yeah.
And you know how hard it is to
yeah, it's awful.
But you became infamous by your surname. Now, I very quickly learned that I quite liked it actually. And yeah, I was like, everyone knows who I am. And people would go, oh, you're Tim Lovejoy because of your name.
Yeah, yeah.
My brother couldn't stand it. And he hated it. And he hated the fact that he had any connection with that, the name at all. It's one of those weird things that you grow up with where your name becomes more important than you, is it?
It's exactly it. But, you know, we all, I think, you know, anyone who could, I think some people can't empathize with being othered at all, which I find, you know, I suspect that Donald Trump has never felt othered in his life.
Yeah.
You know, and I think if you do, if you've ever had anything, then at least you can kind of go, look, I don't have it on the level that you do, but I listen, I buy it when you're telling me that this is happening to you, because I've seen the same behavior in people towards me about something else. And you know, that's what I've, listen, I'm always on the side of the underdog and always will be.
By the way, I was also called Love Juice, Love House, Love Dick, Love. I mean,
Love Dick is good.
The amount of them which the people used to roll, very rarely called Love Joy.
Really? Yeah. That's interesting.
As I grew up, people started calling me Love Joy. Your brother was in Suede as well.
Yeah, he still is, bless him.
Sorry, I said this on the show as well.
No,
was.
It's
right. Like still is. Yeah. You know, found a member of Suede. You were just brought up by your mum?
Yeah.
Just the two brothers? Two brothers. One goes on to be TV, the other goes on to be... I mean, what did she do right?
Yeah, well, that's... It's God, you should get her on. She'd talk to you for a couple of hours about that. You know, she was... Listen, she's sort of horrified that he was in a band. You know, she wanted us... Because, you know, she grew up in a big working-class family. All she wanted us to have proper jobs that paid properly and were like a doctor or a lawyer. That's what she wanted. You know, she worked out that we were bright and she was going to get middle-class kids, and she worked that out quite early. And she's a primary school teacher. And so she worked out very quickly that she was going to be okay and that she was going to have kids who could get into proper jobs and do stuff. And so, yeah, God, the moment I had to say to my mum about a month before my brother broke the news to her that he was going to leave his job and do the band full time. And I sat her down and said, look, Matt's going to come and talk to you. And he's going to say to you that he's leaving his job because he's going to join this band. I said, so you need to, I'm giving you a few weeks to get used to that idea. I said, it's the best idea he's ever had. I said, honestly, you know, you have to come to terms with it. And it was really hard for her. Because what all she wanted, because she grew up with no money, she was obviously, as a single parent, she had no money at all. And, you know, that's her nightmare, is that her kids have no money. All she wants is this next generation, I want them to have money. And obviously, if she looks back now at him at 50 and he's made a load of money out of this band and still makes money out of it now, she would relax. But at the time, it was impossible for her. With Teddy, it was a bit, and because I was a second child as well, Teddy is a bit more like a real career. So she could kind of see...
How long did it take for Sway to... kick off then? And
I mean, from when he left his job, they were pretty successful within 6 months. He was, I can't even remember what he did.
Right.
It was in, you know what, it was like a kind of weird little temping. I mean, it was it was nothing. He wasn't a lawyer or any, you know, it wasn't anything. Within 6 months or so, they were properly sort of touring the world and, you know, money was coming in. But she never really, she didn't find her peace with it for many, many years, which I understand.
Were you on the journey with him?
Yeah, absolutely, which was amazing, you know, because obviously I saw them practicing upstairs in our house and I saw them playing tiny little venues when I was at uni. You know, you go to the Windsor Old Trout or something like this, and then suddenly, you know, there'd be a live review in the NME saying, oh, this band is interesting, this band. And then, you know, they very famously, Melody Maker put them on the cover of Melody Maker before they released a single. And the whole thing just went, crazy. That was back in the days where the music papers, you know, had a lot of sway. And you suddenly they're playing at the Camden, the Electric Ballroom, and like people are going crazy for them. And then they're on telly, they're on like the Late Show. And then on the second single, they're on Top of the Pops. And, you know, it was like, I mean, that was like a dream. And so, you know, you get to go see them play live and all that kind of stuff. And it was incredible because I'm not musical and I'm not cool. So it wasn't trampling over my, there was none of my territory there. So it was amazing. I was so proud of him, and it's such an amazing thing to have gone through. And it's so lovely now that they're still sort of touring and stuff, because my kids are old enough now that, you know, they can go and see them play live. And, you know, actually hipsters quite like Suede. There's like something, you know,
they've always been cool.
They sell their t-shirts in Urban Outfitters and stuff like that, you know, that kind of weird thing. So hipsters still quite like them. And, you know, my kids have been to see them at Glastonbury and the Royal Albert Hall and all this kind of weird stuff. So it's
well, they
it's
were the lovely. One band which wouldn't come on Soccer AM.
Surprise me.
Knowing they liked football, though.
Yeah.
Brett does, anyway.
And, yeah, and Matt.
Yeah, all right. But they wouldn't come on. And I thought it was really good. They were positioning themselves away from Blur, Oasis, and everybody else who was coming on and going, look, we're still music-based band. And I thought that was very clever because they kept their... Not that Soccer AM would make or break a band, but it was
exactly.
It was an interesting... interesting thought process.
No, look, they've always been very true to themselves, you know, which is great. And, you know, it's kind of... paid. I mean, listen, the nice thing now, because lots of bands reform and they play, but they were properly big in Europe and the Far East. I mean, properly big. So they go out now, they can play China and Thailand and Japan and play big, you know, big festivals. So they'll play kind of 20 festivals a year in different countries. And it's, you know, it's... My brother was saying, look, we... In the 90s, where... the only way to make money in a band was sell records. We sold a load of records. And now when the only way to make money in a band is tour, we can tour. You think it's... So you did it the right way around.
What was Britpop like?
You know, I mean, I wasn't massively kind of... Because I'm not cool. I was around the periphery of it. So you'd go to Matt's flat in Camden where he lived with Justin, who was the drummer from Elastica. Who's a lovely fella. And they had Polaroids on the wall of everyone who'd ever been to the flat. And
Horror, he's the drummer in Elastica?
Justin, yeah. Justin Welch.
Right. But Justin Frischman left.
Justin Frischman was in Suede. Yeah. So, and yeah, these all very...
So they're all very well connected. Right,
yeah, okay. Absolutely right.
How was it when she left Suede? Was it a crisis point?
No, because that was very, very early on, right, when they were still just sort of recording, you know, kind of little demos and stuff like that. So it was before... before the kind of big time, even before Simon the drummer joined, I think. So that was very, very early days. But yeah, their wall, they had Polaroids of every single person who'd ever been to that house. And right, it was literally a who's who of... I bet they haven't still got them, but they'd be worth a fortune, all signed.
Okay. Just going back to TV, what's the key to a good quiz show then? Because you've been involved in so many.
Yeah, it's tricky, that, a key to a good quiz show. I mean, it's got to be... it's got to be play along. Is the truth. You know, the rules have got to work. It's got to be like a sport in that you can't ever go, oh, but hold on, that's not fair because, you know, that happened and that didn't happen. But there's no kind of, there's no golden rule because all quiz shows are a little bit different. But, you know, it has to have no moving parts, if you know what I mean. It has to, pointless is quite a clunky format, is the truth. Because over the years, because of the type of questions we have to ask with these lists, we have to keep slightly changing the format and adding bits on. And that's such an exception to the rule, because most formats, you do the format. Yeah. Look at Weakest Link or something like that, or Millionaire. You've got the format, it just works forever and ever, and you just put people inside it. And pointless, that happens to not be the case. So the golden rule is there isn't a golden rule, other than you have to have played it time and time and time and time and time again before you go anywhere near pitching it. Whenever you play it, you have to play it with people who are terrible at quizzes, and then you have to play it with people who are amazing at quizzes, and it has to work both ways. There has to be no workarounds. You know, you can't have brilliant people at quizzes going, oh no, but if I do this, then I know I can get through to the next round even without having to do that. They cannot be a single crack, a single gap anywhere in the format, which is very, very difficult to do, is the truth. So it's absolutely about just playing it again and again and again and again. And actually, when you get it, you recognize it. You just go, this works perfectly. And sometimes it works perfectly, but it's boring. And sometimes it works perfectly, and it's great fun to play, but it's boring to watch.
Where do you find the people to answer the questions on Pointless?
Well, in Pointless, it's all online. So, you know, you sign up to those online agencies and do, you know, a kind of questionnaires and stuff like that, it's all done through one of those.
Right, okay. How do you juggle being on screen and off screen? Only saying that because I've struggled a bit. I was I think I'm a better producer than presenter, personally. Yeah.
But I think it helps to be a presenter. To be a producer helps as a presenter because you know...
Well, what happened to me, you'll like this story, is I was a job trying to be a presenter, and I don't think I was very good. Some would say, Richard, that I'm still not very
good.
You
seem to be doing all right. Listen, I'll tell you what, you've got a nice kitchen for someone who wasn't a good presenter, I'll say that for you.
Thank you very much. So I was writing around to all the agents, and I wrote to Peter Powell. Do you remember?
He was a big agent. Yeah, big agent, James Grant.
And he said, look, you keep writing to me. It's really good. I hassled everybody. I was like that when I was younger. And he said to me, I think what you should do is you're all right sort of at presenting, but I think you should try and get some work behind the camera.
Yeah.
And that meant to me, Peter Powell thinks I'm a brilliant presenter, but I should get some work behind the camera. And so I went and then applied to Planet 24 and blah, blah, blah. I ended up producing The Big Breakfast, et cetera, et cetera. And when I went to Soccer AM, I was writer, producer, presenter. When I moved back to real television, away from satellite, suddenly there was people weren't so keen on the presenter being involved in the production, even though the guys always ask me what I think because I've got to present it. How do you find that, being, you know, having two roles?
Well, it's fascinating because I didn't seek it out. It's the truth. I had no interest in being a presenter, and it was entirely accidental. And my, and so I said, like, I'd give it a go just because I thought it would be an interesting experiment. And I was kind of 40. And you know, when you're 40, you think, actually, I wouldn't mind a different challenge. So I gave it a go. And I think, listen, the thing is, I think as a TV producer, always, that's my brain. Always. And, you know, when I'm in a gallery and a show is going on the floor, you're a bit like a football manager. There's not a lot you can do apart from shout, get back in position. So in the gallery, you can talk down someone's ear and just say, oh, bring person X in, or I think we need to speed this up a bit, or can you mention this? You know, so you're constantly thinking, how does this show feel? How does this show feel? And the presenter is thinking, how do I look here? You know, of course. And so when I've been on, now I'm on camera, I haven't changed the way I think. I think as a producer, and I think, how is this show rather than how am I? Always. Even if I'm a guest on someone else's show, you know, if I got news for you, I'm always thinking, how does this feel? You know, how is this show going? Rather than how am I? And so I love that, because instead of talking down someone's ear, I can just do something immediately. So if I'm doing pointless, I think if I was in the gallery, I'd say X, Y, and Z. But as a presenter, I can just do it. I just say it and I can do it, and it saves everybody an awful lot of time. So I think that I'm using exactly the same bit of my brain. It's the truth. I don't feel... I've never felt any difference between the two roles.
Right, okay. I always think as a producer as well. Recently, we had Russell Brand on the show and he went into one. Right. And being a producer and a presenter, my production head clicked in. I went, this is entertaining.
If I
just shut up now and let him do it, I reckon I think we calculated around 7 minutes without speaking and just let Russell go. But it was gold TV.
Yeah.
I did the same. I was on Soccer Every. I had Noel Gallagher on. And then Dirty Pretty Things turned up. Carl and Dids turned up and they were drunk. And they were so drunk that they could barely speak. It's on YouTube. It's great. And I'm the producer, presenter and everything on that show. And I'm just letting it go. And I knew I had to take them off because it's live.
Yeah.
But I remember going to the toilet in the ad break and giggling away, going, magic TV, magic TV, magic TV. And just trying to go, how long can I keep them on before I get in trouble here?
But
So I've always got that way. And, thinking, oh, let's be generous here with the guests because they're the ones who are going to entertain.
But I think so many good presenters are good producers. Listen, you can tell Anton Deck can produce. You can tell in the heads. You can tell that you can produce. You could tell that, you know, he has many different qualities, but Noel Evans is a great producer. You know, he knows how to produce a TV show.
Yeah.
And so he puts that through in his performance. And so, I just find it's a much easier way of doing the job I used to do.
Yeah.
It's just a much, I just cut out the middleman is all I've done.
If anyone out there wants to be a TV presenter, I really recommend getting some production.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. So many people now on telly started behind the scenes.
And the best part of TV is when it goes wrong. And if you can produce yourself while they're all panicking and going, have we not gone? What's happened?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You can start producing yourself and just get on with it. Because
The amount of times in the nicest possible way, you know, you sort of say you can save a situation on pointless that would necessitate a sort of 10-minute recording break. The moment you could just go, oh no, I know we need to, let's fix that, let's go back, and you can just do it. It's super useful.
Okay, with every guest who comes on the show, we've got three questions we ask them all, so I'm going to ask you the same ones.
Okay.
What one piece of advice would you like to give our listeners that has been invaluable to your life?
Well, there's a piece of advice that was really for my daughter about men, but actually the more I think about the world as it is at the moment, I think it's a good thing to live by, and that's always judge people by what they do rather than what they say. Always. You know, people will literally say anything. It's the truth, because it's really easy, right?
Yeah.
It's easy just to sort of think, oh, I'm just going to say this and this person will be out of my hair or I get this. But, you know, in the extreme circumstance, whereas doing stuff actually takes some effort.
Yeah.
And, you know, you see the truth about people in their behavior rather than what they say. And if you look at someone like Trump at the moment, you know, if you actually put the sum amount of his behavior together rather than the sum amount about what he says, you get a much truer picture of who he is.
And who is that person?
Who is what person?
Trump.
Who is Trump?
Yeah. When you're looking at his actions versus words.
Oh, I think he's a... as a student of politics, I think he's genuinely a disgrace to the office of what he does. I don't mind people's politics. You do what you want. But, you know, he demeans public discourse and he demeans discussion. And I think that's, in a politician, that's the unforgivable sin.
How have we got here, though?
By accident, because again, I said before, we're idiots. You know, we don't know. We don't know how to do things. You know, we've got this enormous media that we don't know how to control. Look at Facebook and Twitter. We've got no idea what we're playing with. We're like kind of monkeys banging rocks together. We don't know. And so these things can be hijacked instantly. And, you know, he got lucky. He got fewer votes than somebody else. But, yeah, just on the day, there's a little tipping point and he won. And there we go. That's 4 years of Trump.
Yeah. Okay. Yep. What mistake? Actually, interestingly, though, judge people on what you do them on what they do them rather than what they say is actually probably a definition for love. You know.
Yeah.
Because it's more than just words. It's actually actions.
Yeah, it's 100% what it is.
Important. Yep. There you go. I've made that really deep for you.
Thank you.
What mistake do people make? Maybe doing your job.
That's an interesting one. Well, what I'd say is this: is that is mistakes are inevitable. If you want to be creative or if you want to take any risks at all, my advice to everyone always is in my company and in other areas is fail well, always fail well, which is because you're going to fail. You've got to build this into your life. You've got to build into your life that you're going to not succeed at stuff. And the amount of times we do shows that don't come off or something like that. But if at the end of that process, you have the people who work with you have enjoyed working with you, the channel you're dealt with have enjoyed dealing with you, you've taken your success, your failure very well, you haven't blamed anyone, you haven't kicked off and sort of going, oh, because the channel scheduled it wrong and blah, 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 which is never true. Then the next time round, people are just going, oh, I want to work with those people again. That was really good fun doing that. I know the show didn't work, but that was really good fun. So you are going to fail and take that opportunity. Companies say it sometimes. If you get a complaint, that's the time you can really get them for life by dealing with them brilliantly. And it's the same in life. If you fail, fail brilliantly and fail in a way that everyone feels like you know, that it was fun working with you.
How many failures have you had?
Oh my God, well, over the years?
Yeah,
well,
TV shows.
It's interesting. I mean, the failure rate for TV shows, I would say, is around 90%. In terms of, you know, very 1 in 10 maybe is a success.
Really?
And, you know, hopefully I've sort of only had 80% failure, so I'm ahead of the game. That's and that 10% margin is where I've made my money.
Well, that's brilliant. Is there one? Well, it's not brilliant. That failures. But is there one that you think should have been a success but just didn't quite make it?
Not really. No. The truth is, most shows fail for a reason. And you know, I see so many people whinge on Twitter about a show. They say, "Oh, I can't believe they've taken off X. They didn't give it a chance." You know, they did 4 series of it, and no one watched. Yeah. You know, that's what do you want people to do? You know, sometimes stuff just doesn't work. So you move on, do the next thing, and if you're good, then the hits will come.
Any life hacks?
Any life hacks? Well, I travel on trains a lot because I don't drive, so I'm always on trains, and I love a train. And the one thing I notice, obviously, get a reservation on if you're going up north, you know, or come down south, get a reservation on a train. But the absolute key thing is don't follow that reservation. If a train is completely full, great, you've got a seat. Trains are very rarely completely full. Go to the very end of standard class or the very end of first class, and there will be a carriage that's empty, because when they reserve trains, they put everyone in the same carriage because it makes it easier for train staff. So if you're in first class or standard, they put everyone in the same carriage. They fill up the seats. And so if they haven't filled it up, there will be one carriage which is entirely empty, and you can just sit there and you have a much nicer journey. And that's in any class you're in. Just go along to that one. Sometimes it doesn't work because the train's full, but it doesn't matter. You've got a seat anyway.
Great tip.
Head up to the very last one of your class.
Final few questions. What's it like to be famous?
It's peculiar, I would say. It's odd. But you know, I really like it. I think because I'm known for shows that people like.
Yeah.
My experience has been almost 100% positive, I would say.
The impact you had from coming on our show amongst all the production staff, they're all so excited you were
coming
on.
That's very sweet.
It's true. You were one of the big guests we've had on.
Oh, that's very kind.
Yeah, people loved it. And what is the meaning of life? Final question.
That is a good question. Well, Gramsci, who the Italian philosopher, he said the meaning of life is whatever the reason is that you don't kill yourself when you wake up in the morning. So that's the meaning of life. Because why didn't you? And you answer that question, and that's the meaning of life.
Right, because it hurts.
Well, there you go. It's too painful not to leave.
To do. Okay. Yeah. Your book, The World Cup of Everything, is out now. It's very good, actually.
It's fun, isn't it?
Really good.
It is a lot.
Yeah, and it is. And I like the idea that you can join in and and do it all. That will have lots of arguments over Christmas with your friends and family. What else have you got coming up? Wave quizzes, pointless.
Yeah, doing 160 new pointless in the new year. A series is called House of Games, a Beauty 2 series, which we did a series of last year, which is really good fun. So we're doing another 50 of those, which I'm really pleased about because it's it was a good laugh. Another Child Genius, I think, in the summer. So lots of bits and bobs.
And if people want to follow you, how do they get hold of you?
At Richard Osman.
Okay,
that's brilliant. It. Osman. There's no D on the end like the Osmonds.
Thanks, Richard. Thanks for coming.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Cheers. I learned a lot, and he got me really excited about TV again. I really like Richard.
Very nice man, wasn't he? I've not met him before, and I'm glad I have.
I just liked his enthusiasm for the TV industry, because sometimes, you know, when you work in an industry like we do, sometimes people get a little bit miserable about it because it's not as it was. It wasn't like it was in the 80s where they were throwing money around everywhere. So it's changed a little bit.
And he's adapted, hasn't he?
Well, I think we all have, but I just think I like the idea that he's still enthusiastic about it. Long live TV! Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. We'll be back very soon with more of the same stuff. I hope you enjoyed it. Let us know what you think. You can tweet me at Tim Lovejoy, email me at dearlovejoypodcast@gmail.com, or you know, you can obviously rate us 5 stars and you can comment here.
Is this our last podcast before Christmas?
Who knows? Watch this space. I don't know, because I don't know what day this is going.
Well, I'm going to say a very Merry Christmas
just in case
to everyone, in case it isn't, and if not, I can do it again.
Okay. That's it. I'll just leave with the usual perf, which is a lot better. Peace
Merry
and
Christmas.
Love, joy.
Bye.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.